Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I'm joined by Andrew Roberts, who is the author of the brand new book, The Last King of America, The Misunderstood Reign of George III. It is available now wherever your books are sold, and it is a fine, hugely engrossing book about somebody who I think he's been, at least according to Andrew's book, kind of misunderstood in American culture. And this doesn't date just back to the Hamilton musical, does it, Andrew?
No, it goes as far as that, certainly to the American Declaration of Independence, where Thomas Jefferson, after that wonderful fine Shakespearean prose at the beginning, the first third or so of it, then for the next two-thirds comes out with a series of 28 personal accusations against George III, only two of which he's guilty of. But those two, about taxation and about Americans making the war in and of themselves, justification for the revolution.
The impetus for this book in your mind and the research behind it, when did they start to come into your mind that you say, okay, this is the time that this book needs to be written, is now?
I had books about Napoleon and Napoleonic wars in the past, so I had George III in the back of my mind for some time, and I knew that he was a wildly misunderstood and underappreciated figure. And then after I'd written the book on Winston Churchill, I had a bit of time on my hands to think about what to do next, and I chose him.
As people in Britain think about George III, or do they even think about him as much as Americans seem to, and you know, and in no small part brought about by the success of the Broadway musical? But is he even a figure in Brits' imaginations now?
He's a bit, because he created a lot of the modern monarchy. His ideas, like he was the person who bought Buckingham Palace and bought the stagecoach and the state's gold coach and organised the treating of the colour and the royal walkabouts and things like that. And he was also somebody who believed in hard work. He Her Majesty the Queen does. He was financially prudent and frugal when it came to eating and drinking. So he very much was a sort of precursor, along with Queen Victoria, of course, to the kind of modern monarchy that the Queen represents.
You mentioned the Declaration of Independence, and clearly when we're taught it in school here in the States, we're taught it as sort of a gospel. You just don't challenge anything it says. Ultimately, it's a political document, though, and the comments made by George III, did you find any impetus for those comments being made in that Declaration of Independence behind, and whether anybody even cared about whether the accusations were true or not?
No, it was a wartime propaganda document, and so perfectly understandably, Thomas Jefferson threw everything into it that he possibly could. But quite a lot of it is ex post facto rationalization. Quite a lot of those charges actually are true of every previous monarch of America going back to Elizabeth I. Several of them are just simply untrue. There's one where George III is accused of taking people abroad, transporting across the oceans for trial, and not a single person was ever transported for trial by George III. So he was sort of packing his briefs likely, as lawyers sometimes do. But as I say, the two key ones, the ones about power of taxation and the ones about the House of Commons having the right to overrule American legislation, were enough to justify what the Founding Fathers did.
When you write in there about the title, The Last King of America, I've got to tell you, it really struck me as that was a watershed moment for me, because I think, gosh, there was a time when America was under a monarchy, and it's just so hard to believe. But as you suggest, the taxation and the no representation in the British House of Commons, how much was the taxation allegations in the how far were they in the Declaration of Independence divorced from reality? Because as I read your book, it seems like the Americans didn't pay a lot of taxes, and the money really stayed in the United States, or in America anyway.
Yes, both of those things are true. You're absolutely right about how we sometimes forget how long America was a monarchy for, because of course it was a monarchy for 150 years before the Declaration of Independence. And so actually it wasn't until the year 1946 that you were a republic longer than you were a monarchy, which is extraordinary thing, considering how far within people's lifetimes. The answer is that Americans paid roughly 2% of what British people paid in taxation. When the Stamp Act came into force in 1765, which of course wasn't widely paid in America at all, but nonetheless, it was intended to raise £40,000, £40,000 and £50,000 from 1.9 million Americans who were not enslaved African Americans. So the amount was absolutely tiny, probably about 2 shillings and 6 pence, which is something like $20 or $30 per annum per American in today's money. So it was a very, very small amount to have a revolution over. And what I try to argue is that it wasn't over that. Of course, it was actually over the fact that America had got to the right stage of its national development to become independent. It was a burgeoning economy. It had 2.5 million people overall. It was very advanced in many ways, and it had no external threats after the French were defeated in the French and Indian Wars. So it was the right time for America to become independent.
Was the American independence an inevitability, and was the war necessarily required to do so?
Nothing in history is an inevitability. It's very important that we always remember that. There's nothing predetermined in history. But it did require a war to do so. There wasn't a time in history where I hardly need to mention to an American with regard to secession movements, that until the year 1905, when a secession, that was Norway and Sweden, splitting up without bloodshed.
Why fight it from the British?
Including Ireland, of course, and also...
I'm chatting with Andrew Roberts about his brand new book, The Last King of America, The Misunderstood Reign of George III. It's available everywhere your books are sold. Andrew, we all know what an American city, municipality, all those look like today government-wise. When America was under monarchy rule, what did the government look like here in the United States when somebody wanted, for instance, to pay their local taxes or to have the local services? How did it look structure-wise? Because I think it's something very foreign to Americans today.
Yes, well, it was. It was totally foreign. It was absolute minimalist, really. In Virginia, there were only 17 royal servants, i.e. bureaucrats, administrators. And in South Carolina, there were only 40. It was absolutely as light-handed as possible. The royal governors and the local assemblies really came up with the laws. So George III wasn't interested in altering laws in America in the slightest, except for this process of raising taxation. And every penny of that tax was going to be spent in America, which is something else that's often sort of misconceived about his taxation policy.
Had the British won the Revolutionary War, would there have been any way to mend those wounds? I mean, was there a plan for Britain that would have involved victory here in the Revolutionary War?
Yes, there was actually. There was a strategic plan and a political plan. The strategic plan was to try and send Sir John Burgoyne south from Canada to get to Albany and then split off the Hudson Valley. So at the same time, Sir William Howe came up from New York, and they were going to try and use the Hudson Valley to split the New England colonies away from the rest of the colonies. It wasn't an impossible plan to succeed, but as you say, you're fighting from 3,000 miles away, and logistically it was tremendously difficult to pull off. But the political plan was to try to appease the Americans as much as possible by offering them, which they did do in something called the Carlisle Commission in 1778, essentially everything that they wanted. So Parliament was going to lose the right to tax America, and was also going to lose the right to legislate for America or to veto American laws. So it was going to, in a sense, give home rule on the basis that the war ended.
We know from studying American history this whole phrase, large extended commercial republic. And I think a lot of that came from Alexis de Tocqueville and his Democracy in America book. But with as vast as America ended up becoming, would that have expansion even been under monarchy rule?
No, because in 1763, the King George III passed a proclamation, which essentially tied the 13 colonies to the eastern side of the Allegheny Mountains. And so it would have stuck you there, and basically the whole of the rest of the continent was going to be one gigantic Native American reservation. And that was obviously something that a lot of the founding fathers, especially George Washington, who had some money in the land speculation scheme in the Ohio Valley and elsewhere, just couldn't put up with, and it was a major reason for them rebelling.
You get into a lot about George III's medical conditions and mental health conditions in this book, and we all have seen the movie The Madness of King George here in the United States, or a lot of us have, and so we have these two images of King George, tyrant and crazy, and you kind of delve into the records of all of that. Where was George III mental-wise when he was, you know, and it's that's this stage of his mental illness that has now become known as madness here, just in a very nutshell version in the United States?
Yes, well, first of all, not porphyria. That is an old theory, half a century old, and I think I can completely explode it in my book. All the modern medical thought on this matter has him have bipolar disorder, affective type 1. And it was a form of manic depression, and although he did have a prodrome attack of it in 1765 at the time of the passing of the Stamp Act, there's no sense that had he been entirely sane that anything would have been different politically. But then he didn't go, didn't have another bout of mental illness until 1788, 5 years after America had become independent. So it didn't affect the American War of Independence or the run-up to it, really, at all whatsoever, which is another great sort of misconception, I think, about George III. And now that we've destigmatized mental health and mental illness so successfully and finally, I think it's possible to realize that he wasn't, as some of the historians of the 19th and 20th centuries made him out to be. It wasn't his fault, you know, that he got mad. It wasn't he wasn't suffering from some kind of a moral weakness in the way that historians have again and again implied that he had.
How protective is the monarchy of George III's reputation?
Quite supportive. Prince Charles has he wrote a foreword to a biography, an earlier biography of George III, which was very supportive of his ancestor. I was at a party at St. James's Palace the week before last, and the Duchess of Cornwall said that she was reading my book at the moment and finding it interesting. So I think they are interested. You would be interested, wouldn't you, if you had, you know, severe mental illness in your family, even though it was 250 years ago.
The book is just fabulous. It's called The Last King of America, The Misunderstood Reign of George III by Andrew Roberts. The book is available everywhere. Check it out. It's just so interesting, and there's some great paintings in here and historical documents quoted. Andrew, just a fantastic book, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
You're so fine. Thank you very much indeed.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
You'll be back soon, you'll see.